Yeah, so I you know, the norms are quite strong, in fact. I mean, what norms do, I mean, what they're unwritten rules, but in order to be a norm, people have to feel some sanction, some punishment, finger wagging or whatever, or, you know, criticism. You know there's a norm when people react to violations of it with condemnation. I mean, there's no formal sanction, there's no formal punishment, but there's kind of informal punishment. You know, I think these norms actually are quite robust. They haven't always existed throughout American history. I mean, they didn't exist in the 1790s in the U.S. when Democrats and Republicans viewed each other as agents of foreign powers. You know, the Federalists were agents of the British and the Republicans were agents of the French. And so, you know, they certainly didn't exist in the Civil War, I mean, where people literally went to war with each other because of fundamental disagreements. So they, you know, were slowly reconstructed after the end of the Civil War, you know, in the beginning of the 20th century. And so I think they have been quite robust, and they lasted really until the 1990s. And what the kind of trigger, the kind of moment of degeneration began, I would argue, I mean, I put the blame at the Republican Party in the over the course of the 1990s under Newt Gingrich and the retake of the House of Representatives. And there was a kind of consistent attack on these basic norms, both at a very kind of local level within Congress. I mean, you can see that the frequency of the filibuster increased. This was abandoning a norm of forbearance. The frequency of, you know, the partisan impeachment of Bill Clinton violated a norm that you shouldn't carry out an impeachment that has no chance of actually succeeding. And it was clear this was not going to be supported by the Senate. And yet Republicans went ahead anyway, partly just to damage their political rival. So this was using the institutions to the hilt. And so we begin to see this gradual process. And I guess the reason the norms begin to decay is when each side begins to respond. And I think Democrats have not been entirely innocent. Under the Bush administration, I mean, there was a lot of court nominees that went forward, and the Senate began to use the filibuster to block this. So that what pushes this forward is exactly the escalation. So it's rarely just one side doing it. Certainly one side might be doing it worse than the other side, but you get a kind of spiral where both sides feel like idiots if they don't use it. Talk to Republicans. They can find the things that they think that where Democrats broke the rules. Democrats can find the things where they think Republicans broke the rules. This is exactly this dynamic where neither side kind of can legitimately claim purity that generates this kind of very dangerous precedent. And again, looking throughout history, Spain in the 1930s, Germany in the 1930s, these kinds of environments where there is this spiral that political leaders who are autocratic become more appealing to kind of resolve it. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, as tempting as it is, I mean, we have to think of ways of acting in robust, vigorous ways without abandoning norms. I don't know if you...
Yeah, I don't know what that... You know, I think that makes a good sort of story, the prisoner's dilemma or, you know, the coordination game. But I think in many of the examples that you cite correctly as these peaceful takeover of democracy, you don't really see the escalation of the form that you describe. You know, there are other things that socially polarize society. So I think the emphasis on polarization is absolutely right. But this escalation, you know, I don't see an equivalent of that in the Philippines. There was certainly no equivalent of it in Turkey. In fact, you know, the problem in Turkey was that as Erdogan's AKP started using more and more hardball tactics, the opposition really was extremely acquiescing. I don't really see any equivalent of that in Venezuela or Russia. I mean, in Venezuela, obviously, there was a huge rotten system which undergirded Chavez's rise to power. But as Chavez started using all of these various dirty tactics, you know, the referendum that he wasn't supposed to have called, which he lost, and then he still went on implemented, there wasn't much that Congress did to escalate that. So I think the escalation obviously might contribute, but I don't think it's a necessary condition. And I guess the issue there, you know, when are we really talking about an existential threat? So I don't doubt that escalation would contribute to it, but I don't think that it's a necessary condition. And the question becomes, as you very aptly put, oh, you know, I think the other side coming to power or becoming more powerful is an existential threat, so therefore I should escalate and I should play hardball too. But sometimes we do have an existential threat. And, you know, when Hitler was appointed chancellor, that was an existential threat, but the conservatives didn't see it that way, and they are corporal. They brought him to power, but they also worked with him quite closely, at least until the night of the long lives. So we might well be at a point of existential threat. So I'm not sure. I hope I don't have to make the decision for everybody.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I don't think that this is a kind of single answer at all times, just forbear. I mean, I recommend to everybody a wonderful novel by Leon Feuchtwanger, a German novelist who wrote this book called The Oppermanns, which is a work of a novel. It was written about a Jewish German family in Berlin in the 1930s. And what's amazing about the book is written in 1934, you know, within months of Hitler coming to power. And it's about this family. And as they're trying to cope with the context of, you know, transforming Germany within the first year of Hitler coming to power, and all the wise characters in the novel, I mean, this is very kind of wealthy, prominent family in Berlin, the lawyers, the doctors, the professors, they're all saying, well, come on, don't overreact, things aren't so bad. And these kind of crazy characters, like one of the daughters wants to move to Israel and is a Zionist, and, you know, and the portrayal of her, you sort of think this is somebody you wouldn't necessarily think has the right answer. She's the one saying, no, we have to get out. This is a disaster. We need to fight hard. So it turns out in that case, she was certainly right. And these, the kind of wise old men were not right. And so I think in many instances, forbearance needs to be abandoned. But I guess that the point is that it can also potentially exacerbate. I don't think, sure. I agree that it's not necessary. It's not a necessary condition. And so the challenge is to kind of figure out under what conditions is this necessary and at what point are we genuinely facing a threat. And I guess I would argue that as long as there are continue to be channels of genuine democratic competition available, that they should be utilized. You know, so as long as there are free and fair elections, you know, we need to have an election in the fall in the United States and, you know, hopefully things change. If they don't, then, you know, we'll come back, we'll have another session next spring. Right.
I may give a different talk. I think that's 100% correct. I think we are talking about challenges and threats, but nobody, I think, is seriously arguing that U.S. government has been completely taken over and all of the institutions have collapsed. And although there are questions about what will happen when Trump loses, will there be violence, et cetera? I think there are some real questions about that. But I think there is no doubt that the midterm elections are likely to be free and fair. So the most immediate thing is for people to actually go and vote. Young people are among some of the most exercised, rightly, about Trump's presidency. But if young people voted at the same rate as over 55s, today we wouldn't be talking about Trump. But they didn't. So turnout was very low among certain groups, and including Hispanics, excluding not so low, but lower still than it should have been among African Americans. And if more people actually turn out to the midterm elections, the outcome is going to be very different.